This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, new U.S. sanctions against Russia over the crisis in Ukraine. Libya seeking help to fight terrorism.
They really are looking for military assistance that in reality they're not going to get.
Syria tops a list of asylum seekers. The Exxon Valdez oil spill 25 years later. And a new dinosaur is identified. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. In response to Russia's recent actions concerning the cessation of Crimea from Ukraine, President Barack Obama has announced new U.S. steps against the nation. He said sanctions will be imposed on more senior officials of the Russian government and a number of other individuals with substantial resources and influence who provide material support to the Russian leadership, as well as a bank that provides material support to those individuals. And he said, because of apprehension about Russia's military activities in the region, U.S. activities will not stop there.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military in a way that could lead to further incursions into southern and eastern Ukraine. For this reason, we've been working closely with our European partners to develop more severe actions that could be taken if Russia continues to escalate the situation. As part of that process, I signed a new executive order today that gives us the authority to impose sanctions not just on individuals, but on key sectors of the Russian economy. This is not our preferred outcome. These sanctions would not only have a significant impact on the Russian economy, but could also be disruptive to the global economy. However, Russia must know that further escalation will only isolate it further from the international community. The basic principles that govern relations between nations in Europe and around the world must be upheld in the 21st century. That includes respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity. The notion that nations do not simply redraw borders or make decisions at the expense of their neighbors simply because they are larger or more powerful.
Mr. Obama stressed again that the door to diplomacy on the Crimea issue is not shut.
Diplomacy between the United States and Russia continues. We've emphasized that Russia still has a different path available, one that de-escalates the situation and one that involves Russia pursuing a diplomatic solution with the government in Kiev, with the support of the international community. The Russian people need to know, and Mr. Putin needs to understand, that the Ukrainians shouldn't have to choose between the West and Russia. We want the Ukrainian people to determine their own destiny and to have good relations with the United States, with Russia, with Europe, with anyone that they choose. That can only happen if Russia also recognizes the rights of all the Ukrainian people to determine their future as free individuals and as a sovereign nation. Rights that people and nations around the world understand and support.
President Obama speaking at the White House. Russian forces effectively took control of Crimea 2 weeks ago in the wake of the ouster of Ukraine's pro-Russian president, Viktor Yanukovych, after months of protests and sporadic violence. Earlier, the United States placed sanctions limiting travel and economic activity on 21 people involved in the Kremlin's actions against Ukraine. Russia has maintained troop buildups on the border with eastern Ukraine, and Ukraine's defense chiefs have started moving military hardware to the frontier. But local pro-Russian activists have been hindering the redeployment by blocking roads and rail links. Jamie Detmer has details from Donetsk.
On a highway on the outskirts of the eastern Ukraine city of Donetsk, pro-Russian activists have been keeping vigil, looking out for any Ukrainian military convoys. They vow to stop Ukrainian military movements by dashing into the road and refusing to budge. Igor, a 33-year-old truck driver, says they've managed this week to stop three rocket launches being moved closer to the border. He has no regrets. He says he and other ethnic Russian agitators are doing this because of the current political crisis, arguing that the government in Kiev wants to turn people into slaves and shouldn't be sending troops or military hardware into peaceful regions. The group tries to maintain about 30 activists here 24 hours a day, and if they need more backup, they can summon 200 supporters within half an hour. They have managed in the past 4 days to turn back 3 convoys. Dozens of such checkpoints have sprung up across the Donbass region of eastern Ukraine, the most densely populated of all the regions of the country, and Ukraine's industrial powerhouse, producing coal and metals. Ethnic Russians don't dominate to the same degree as in Crimea, where leaders signed a treaty this week with Russia absorbing the Black Sea Peninsula into the Russian Federation after a disputed referendum. According to a 2011 census, 48% of the population of Donetsk is ethnic Russian and 46% ethnic Ukrainian. Despite what Igor says, Donetsk and some other towns in the region have been anything but peaceful. 3 people have died in clashes at protests, one a pro-Ukrainian history student. Pro-Russian activists protested earlier this month in Donetsk City Hall before being evicted and their leader, who proclaimed himself the people's governor, arrested. Sasha, a salesman and divorced father of a 2-year-old boy, says it would be better if Donetsk followed the example of Crimea and became part of the Russian Federation. In a Tuesday speech, Russian President Vladimir Putin indicated that he had no further designs on Ukraine territory and wasn't planning on moving into eastern Ukraine. This isn't deterring pro-Russian activists and preparing for a clash of arms between Ukrainian and Russian soldiers, and they plan to mount more checkpoints across the region to block Ukrainian military movements. This past weekend, a group blocked the rail line near Luhansk, north of Donetsk, with metal debris, stopping a military train carrying tanks. And the activists say they won't stop these types of activities. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Donetsk.
Libya is calling on the international community to help it fight what it says is war on terrorism. In a statement, the country's interim government said it especially wants United Nations assistance in uprooting terrorism from Libyan cities. We asked Robert Powell, a senior Middle East analyst with the Economist Intelligence Unit, his reaction to Libya's request.
The request, in all honesty, appears slightly misleading. The Libyan government is confronted by a plethora of problems, including groups that are indeed aligned to al-Qaeda. But the reality is that the rule of law is exceptionally weak throughout the country, and political parties really across the board, be it the extremists or not, have their own military arms. This is essentially a natural consequence of the civil war that ousted Muammar Gaddafi, and many of the powerful players, some of them very regionally aligned, have refused to give up their arms, refused to join the army, and in effect refused to go back to civilian life. The result is that the government's writ is very narrow, and it's struggling badly to maintain control throughout the country. The net result has been rising popular disquiet with the behavior and inability to function of the government entities within Tripoli, and also enormous disruption for the economy, in particular the vital oil sector.
Perhaps the international community could help with intelligence, but militarily, is that a possibility that the international community will step into Libya militarily?
I think that analysis is absolutely correct. Beyond offering surveillance aircraft, some intelligence on the ground, the West themselves are highly unlikely to actually put troops on the ground or even launch the kind of airstrikes that we saw during Libya's civil war in 2011. The most that Libya can expect, as I said, is perhaps some training of its forces. And there is actually a number of cross-border efforts being made to equip its troops and also to offer them far more of the expertise they require for the difficult task of rooting out al-Qaeda-aligned groups. But that's about as much as they're going to get. Financially, despite the extremely depressed level of oil production, and they're probably not really looking for extra cash because the country can still rely on the enormous hoards of money built up in its sovereign wealth fund over the past decades. And so they really are looking for military assistance that in reality they're not going to get.
When the Arab Spring occurred, there was optimism about the MENA region. Has it actually brought more terrorism to the region or resulted in that?
Essentially, the Arab Spring opened Pandora's box. So a whole host of different grievances have bubbled to the surface. And initially, it should be noted that extremist groups, such as those that would be sympathetic to the Al-Qaeda's ideology, performed extremely badly. When you saw people of all ages and all genders, men and women, out on the streets together protesting, it undermined Al-Qaeda's argument that the only way to bring down corrupt regimes was terrorism, was violence. However, as you say, as in fact many of these revolutions have since been rolled back, or at least stagnated, it's proffered some relief to groups like Al-Qaeda or Salafis, who take a far more hardline approach to reform, and also a far more skeptical, or in some cases outright hostile, to democracy. So it is offering some succor to extremist ideology at the moment. But I wouldn't want to go as far as to say that across the region, Al-Qaeda has been given a second wind, if you like, from the Arab Spring. Initially, that was actually quite the reverse. Only in more isolated cases has it benefited, probably most notably in the case of Syria, where a long-lasting war has caused all kinds of unpleasant characters to come out of the woodwork and cross over the borders from Iraq. But Syria should be viewed in isolation. Al-Qaeda has come back to the surface, got weak, and its fortunes have waxed and waned over the years, and it may appear to be coming back now. But all it would take was some kind of positive democratic development of the kind we're seeing in Tunisia to see its fortunes wane once again.
Robert Powell, a senior Middle East analyst with the Economist Intelligence Unit in New York. A new report finds that Syria is turning out the largest number of people seeking asylum in industrialized countries. The UN Refugee Agency's just released report on asylum trends in 2013 shows a sharp rise in asylum claims in 44 industrialized countries last year. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The report says nearly 613,000 people lodged claims for asylum in North America, Europe, East Asia, and the Pacific last year. This is the highest total for any year since 2001. The UNHCR says this sharp rise in asylum seekers is being driven primarily by the crisis in Syria. That country now tops the list as the world's main origin for asylum seekers, bumping Afghanistan into second position with Russia in third place. The director of UNHCR's Division of International Protection, Volker Türk, calls Syria an international game changer. He says the number of Syrian asylum seekers shows how that country is affecting other regions and countries in the industrialized world, although they are far removed from the crisis in the Middle East.
Last year I was in Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, and it is clear that the longer people are in displacement, in often very difficult situations in the neighboring countries, the more you will see that desperation drives them to get on with their lives, to reunite with family members in other countries, and to find ways and means to get out of often a very difficult situation.
The report finds that six of the top 10 countries of origin are experiencing violence or conflict. They are Syria, Afghanistan, Eritrea, Somalia, Iraq, and Pakistan. It notes the 38 countries in Europe attracted the biggest increase in asylum claims, nearly 485,000. Germany received the largest number, followed by France and Sweden. The report says North America received the second highest number of asylum claims, amounting to nearly 99,000. It says the United States is second only to Germany in the number of applications received. Turk says the numbers of asylum seekers in this year's report clearly reflects what is happening in the world today.
You will see that the numbers in relation to Central African Republic national seeking asylum is not yet reflected in these numbers, neither is South Sudanese. But as we could see with Syrians, there may well be at some stage, the longer a conflict lasts, you may see the ripple effects of current crises that have not yet had an impact on the industrialized world. The longer these crises last, they may well have an impact on the industrialized world.
The report says the acceptance rate of asylum seekers, those who are recognized as refugees or are given temporary international protection, varies widely. It says they tend to be higher among people fleeing conflict. For example, it notes acceptance rates for people from Syria, Eritrea, Iraq, Somalia, and Afghanistan are between 62% and 95%. On the other hand, it says acceptance rates from nationals of the Russian Federation, most of whom are Chechens, in Serbia and Kosovo are significantly lower. These countries, which are not at war, have an acceptance rate of around 28% and 5%, respectively. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
In the early morning hours of March 24, 1989, a huge tanker sailed from Valdez at the terminus of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline into Prince William Sound. Then the Exxon Valdez struck a reef and spilled 41.5 million liters of crude oil. 25 years ago, it was the largest oil spill in U.S. history, overtaken in 2010 by the BP Deepwater Horizon rig accident in the Gulf of Mexico. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports the Exxon Valdez spill marked a turning point in prevention and response to such accidents.
Oceanographer Debbie Payton was called to Alaska a few hours after the spill by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She discovered a community in shock.
At the town meeting, I would describe it chaos, confusion, people upset because of lack of information. How could this happen in our very pristine and beautiful backyard?
Payton's job was to help predict where the oil would go. On day one, she saw the eerie black sheen on Prince William Sound. 3 days later, a storm picked up, and over the next weeks and months, the oil spread to beaches and coves along the rocky coastline.
There were oiled birds. There were some marine mammals that could be seen surfacing through the oil. There was oil on beaches.
Responders deployed skimmers, booms, and chemical dispersants. They burned oil and sprayed steam on rocks. Recovery was slow, the location remote, and the environmental loss staggering, with hundreds of thousands of seabirds, otters, seals, bald eagles, and whales dead. Payton now heads NOAA's Office of Response and Restoration, which has monitored the Exxon Valdez spill since the beginning. She says while pockets of oil are still visible, the coast and the fisheries appear healthy, with some notable exceptions.
There are still some concerns with one of the fisheries, the herring fishery.
The herring industry, once a thriving coastal business, has collapsed. This former fisherman, who didn't give his name, bears the scars. He doubts whether herring will ever be fished commercially here again.
Typically, say, for the herring season, we might have made $35,000, $40,000. Now, nothing, of course. Nothing.
The lawsuits filed against Exxon ended with a 2008 Supreme Court ruling, which capped punitive damages at $2.5 billion. While the company has spent over $4 billion in compensation, cleanup payments, settlements, and fines, critics allege that it's not enough. But ExxonMobil spokesman Richard Kyle, who spoke with VOA on Skype, calls it a fair deal.
We took immediate responsibility for the spill, and the payments we've made are based on agreements worked out in court with input from all parties. It's also important to note that the company voluntarily compensated more than 11,000 Alaskans and businesses within a year of the spill.
Kyle says that the Exxon Valdez accident marked a low point in corporate history, but also sparked a dramatic shift to put safety first.
It's the number one factor guiding any and all business decisions we make. We want to protect the environment we're operating in, the communities we're part of, and our employees, contractors, and the people who live near our operations.
Exxon Valdez was the impetus for other changes, too, says NOAA's Debbie Payton, starting with a new law, the Oil Pollution Act of 1990.
it led to double hulled tankers. It led to community action groups, better integration with response communities from all the way from the oil spill response organizations, private entities, responsible parties through the state and federal governments.
Peyton's office responds to between 100 and 150 spills a year. She says a new generation of booms, skimmers, and dispersants remain in NOAA's arsenal, but the agency has added other tools like an online data system, which records ocean currents and ship locations and predicts the path of oil in real time.
And that allows us to just pull pieces of information together quicker and see them quicker so that we can make decisions that much quicker.
Peyton says what scientists learn from one accident helps them better prepare for the next. But Chuck Klusen, who heads Alaska Projects for the Natural Resources Defense Council, sees it another way, especially as the U.S. considers drilling in pristine areas of the Arctic.
It's a wake-up call for operations generally on the oceans involving oil. And the government and the industry must take heed to that and understand that there are places that you simply cannot go.
If Exxon Valdez has taught us anything, Klusen says, it is to fairly weigh the ecological risk against the economic benefit of oil extraction. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Paleontologists have identified the remains of a previously unknown bird-like species of dinosaur that roamed North America almost 70 million years ago. The giant feathered creature belongs to a group of plant and meat eaters found in Central and East Asia. VOA's Jessica Berman has details.
It looked like a cross between an enormous chicken and a giant lizard, producing what one paleontologist described as a stretched-out chicken. The dinosaur, now called Anzu Wiley, had a beak but no teeth, a long neck, a bony crest on top of its head, and razor-sharp claws.
So you basically have this great big bird-like creature with a long tail, long arms, ending in huge claws, feathers over all of its body.
Hans-Dieter Seuss is curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History.
Even though we haven't gotten the actual feather fossils from Anzu, we have closely related animals from China, which are actually preserved with beautiful feather impressions.
The new species was identified from three sets of fossils unearthed from the Upper Cretaceous Hell Creek Formation in North and South Dakota, giving it the nickname the Chicken from Hell. It stood more than 3.5 meters tall and weighed between 200 and 300 kilograms. An almost complete skeleton resides at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Smithsonian paleontologists discovered one of the fossils and helped describe the findings, which are reported in the journal PLOS One. Seuss says the giant feathered species belongs to a family of omnivorous dinosaurs called Oviraptorosauria. He says Anzu, named for a mythological winged creature from Mesopotamia, ate both plants and animals, preferring to live in swampy areas. One of the very last dinosaurs to inhabit the United States, Seuss says Anzu existed alongside the horned Triceratops and ferocious Tyrannosaurus rex. But with its long, powerful legs and clawed winged tips, the dinosaur was not easy prey.
Anyone who has ever sort of tried to corner an ostrich today has lived to regret this, because these animals are certainly, when they are cornered, they will certainly defend themselves very effectively. And particularly this animal with its huge hand claws would certainly shredded any attacker.
The dinosaur family to which A. Wiley and its Asian cousins belong was extremely diverse, including species as small as turkeys and as large as Anzu. For almost 100 years, scientists have suspected the existence of giant oviraptorosaurs in North America. The latest fossil evidence confirms that. Seuss says there may be bones in other collections that will help paleontologists paint a more detailed picture of Anzu. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 21st, 1685, German composer Johann Sebastian Bach was born. A church organist by profession, Bach composed some of the greatest works in music history. In 1871, journalist Henry Morton Stanley began his search for missionary and explorer David Livingstone, who was believed to be lost in Africa. In 1925, President Syngman Rhee was removed from office after being impeached by the Korean Provisional Authority following charges of abuse of power. He would later become the first president of South Korea, where his authoritarian tendencies once more resulted in his being forced from office. In 1927, troops from the military arm of the Chinese Nationalist Party, or Kuomintang, approached the city of Shanghai, where communist allies under the leadership of Zhou Enlai had already fomented an uprising. The forces took over the city as troops supporting local warlords fled. In 1952, Cleveland disc jockey Alan Freed held what was considered to be the first rock concert in history. The Moondog Coronation Ball, a live dance event, attracted more than 20,000 teenagers to the Cleveland Arena, which had a capacity of only about 10,000. Police brought the overbooked show to a close. On this day in 1939, singer Kate Smith recorded this song by immigrant composer Irving Berlin, written as a tribute to his adopted country.
God bless America.
Following the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the U.S., members of the United States Congress stood on the steps of the Capitol building and sang this song, God Bless America. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has ordered the immediate suspension of all operations of the Syrian embassy and has ordered all personnel who are not American citizens or legal residents to leave the U.S. The order means that Syria's embassy in Washington, D.C. will effectively be closed, along with its honorary consulates in Troy, Michigan and Houston, Texas. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki said diplomats and their families will have until March 31st to get their affairs in order and depart. Administrative staff will have until April 30th to appropriately shutter the mission before they must depart. According to Special Envoy to Syria Daniel Rubenstein, the U.S. order was given after the Syrian embassy in Washington announced that it had suspended its provision of consular services and in consideration of the atrocities the Assad regime has committed against the Syrian people. In a statement, he said, "We have determined it is unacceptable for individuals appointed by that regime to conduct diplomatic or consular operations in the United States." Mr. Rubenstein noted that this week marks the 3-year anniversary of the Syrian revolution. For 3 years, said Mr. Rubenstein, Bashar al-Assad has refused to heed the call of the Syrian people to step aside. He has directed a war against his own people and created a humanitarian catastrophe in order to hold on to power and protect his narrow interests. Asked about the closing of the embassy at a town hall meeting with university students in Washington, Secretary of State John Kerry pointed to the illegitimacy of the Assad regime, noting the deaths of 140,000 Syrians, more than 10,000 of whom are children, the millions of refugees and internally displaced persons, the use of chemical weapons and barrel bombs by the Syrian government. Mr. Kerry said, "We just felt the idea that this embassy is sitting here with representation that we could take seriously is an insult, and we closed it." Special Envoy Rubenstein noted that the U.S. has not severed diplomatic relations with Syria. The United States continues to maintain diplomatic relations with the state of Syria as an expression of our long-standing ties with the Syrian people, an interest that will endure long after Bashar al-Assad leaves power. The United States, he said, will continue to assist those seeking change in Syria to help end the slaughter and to resolve the crisis through negotiations for the benefit of the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.